when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
In 2020, events have yet again shone a light on racial inequalities across the globe. Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now. Not ever.
These comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
But I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Hi there, Mark Kenny from ANU's Australian Studies Institute here for this week's Democracy Sausage, coming to you as always from the ANU's studio at the Crawford School of Public Policy and with support of the fabulous School of Politics and International Relations. Well, I'm happy to say my prediction of a Democratic win in the 2020 election, as made many times on this podcast, has turned out to be correct, as did, largely speaking, the logic underpinning it. My assessment was that Donald Trump was the worst president in modern US history and had done little to expand his base. Now, it's true that he did secure more than 70 million votes in this election, so numerically he did expand his base, I guess you could say. But let me make a couple of points on that. One, unlike 2016, he was a sitting president, not a mere untried novice outsider, so his incumbency was also always going to be a plus. Just look at how he shamelessly used the White House and Air Force One, etc., in the election campaign itself, and you can certainly see how he parlayed that incumbency. You know, in that sense, he was always going to, I think, be in a better position than he was going into 2016. And two, it's possible that many of those who voted for him in 2020 had been non-participants in 2016, given that a Clinton win was widely expected. So The debate about whether he sort of truly expanded his base, I think, you know, will be had, and those numbers will have to be broken down, disaggregated, and some judgments will be made about that. But I think we can say that in any event, right, it doesn't matter how you get there. It's whether you get enough votes, and he didn't get enough votes, and he certainly didn't get them in the right places. And besides, Joseph P. Biden got more, perhaps 5 million more votes. And the best thing Biden had going for him, as well as decency and respect, was the disgust, betrayal, and embarrassment many Americans felt for the 45th president. It was true that democracy was on the ballot. It's also true to say that Trump was on both ballots too, in a sense, in that Biden was a vote for Biden was in fact very much a vote against Trump and Trumpism. Hence my point that no president has learned less on the job nor done more to expand his opponent's electoral base. Now, with those comments, let's bring in our panel, who know a lot more about these things than I do. First, as always, Dr. Maria Tafflaga is a lecturer in the School of Politics and International Relations and heads up the Centre for the Study of Australian Politics. Welcome again, Maria, as always.
Hello, and some fun facts about Donald Trump. He is the only president to have been impeached, to have lost the popular vote, and to be a one-term president. So that's a pretty devastating centre of a Venn diagram there for someone who does not like being on the wrong side of history.
No, he doesn't. In fact, as far as he's concerned, he still isn't on the wrong side of history, and I guess we'll come to that. Dr. Charles Miller, or Charlie, I believe we call you.
Yep, that's fine. Yep, Charlie.
He's also a political scientist based at the School of Politics and International Relations, and you specialise in defence and security issues.
Yep, that's right. Yep, foreign policy, broadly conceived as well. Yep.
Excellent. Welcome to Democracy Sausage.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Jennifer Hunt is a researcher at the ANU's National Security College, based here in the same building as we're producing this podcast out of. And you may have seen her excellent commentary on Election Day on the ABC, sitting on the panel there and providing extremely expert opinion, rich content. Jennifer, welcome to Democracy Sausage.
Thank you, and hello.
Now, let's get down to it. Let's get some sort of perspectives from you, because when you were talking on the ABC on Election Day, on that Wednesday, things were very, very unclear, and they stayed unclear for a great deal of time. They stayed heavily contested. The networks, who we now know, I guess we've had all been schooled in this in recent days, were very cautious, really, about how to read the numbers. They've now made the call. It's very clear who's won the election. Donald Trump still doesn't believe it, of course.
Well, that's true. But Donald Trump still believes that he won the popular vote in 2016 as well.
And so, had the biggest inauguration audience as well.
Exactly. So he has made a name and a political career in peddling conspiracy theories, and he will probably end it on one as well about voter fraud.
Did you see the rally addressed by, well, if you could call it that, the event addressed by Donald Jr., where he talked about the Republican Party and said that the Republican Party of old would have just, effectively said that, would have laid down and accepted this, but the Republican Party now has a backbone and we're going to fight and continue to fight. What do you make of that kind of statement? Well, I mean, is he shaping up for 2024 himself?
Well, to me, it just demonstrates the hostile takeover of the Republican Party by the Trump family themselves. The fact that we even have the president's son out there with a platform, his children getting security clearances, becoming White House officials, but then demurring any hard questions as, well, I can't answer any questions about Dad. So I think the fact that he is the front man demonstrates that the Trump family is front and center, and will be using that to launch their own campaigns in future.
What do you think, what does anyone think about my proposition that Trump hasn't particularly expanded his base?
I'd like to think that that's true, but there's certainly some indication from the pre-election polling and from the exit polling that he may have done somewhat better amongst African-American and Latino men. Mm. Now, because the exit polling was basically people were voting on the day, I'm not really sure how much we can actually trust that. So we'll have to wait for a while. But it's possible that that has happened. And that's, I mean, let's put it mildly, surprising that this has happened. But it may indeed be the case. And what's shocking, I think, really, is the fact that he hasn't lost more support, ultimately. I mean, if you look, Don Jr. is talking about the Republican Party of old. I mean, in American politics in the 60s or the 70s, when you still could have massive blowout landslide elections, somebody who had mishandled something like the coronavirus as badly as Donald Trump has, he would have been lucky to carry more than two or three states. So, I mean, the fact that he hasn't, that has not happened is, I mean, a pretty incredible testament to the power of partisanship, especially in the Republican-supporting red state portion of America.
Maria, how much do you put that down? I mean, it's a really good point. And how much do you put that down to to media, to the segregated media, or the sort of media that now operates to various niche conspiracies? America is obviously intensely kind of divided, as we know, and we have media that are very partisan, media operators that are extremely partisan, and they're sort of barricades for one side or the other. And clearly, that's had this. I mean, it's a complex relationship, which came first, but it's had a intensifying effect on the political process.
Sure. I think the media definitely has a big role to play in how people are getting their information in the United States. We could sort of say a similar thing about any democracy at the moment, perhaps not to the same extreme. I think one of the things that sort of struck me was the sort of data visualizations that came out about voting patterns across the United States. And, we often conceive of things as sort of red states or blue states. But what sort of struck me was for example, the big difference between cities and rural localities, which sort of goes to a big divide in American politics between people who do live in big city centres and people who feel left behind in sort of smaller rural communities, sort of building on what Charlie said. I mean, I think I saw reports that counties that had very high death rates from coronavirus actually increased Trump's vote share, which I just find that very difficult to compute, like how the hell can that possibly be? And I do sort of wonder, like, how much of it is it really possible for us to sort of understand from this distance the type of polarization that has kind of gone on in the United States?
Well, doesn't that just prove a kind of like prima facie a deep polarization that it's so deep, in fact, that the coronavirus itself has become a matter of political contest? Even when people are dying in a relatively small community, this has become the China virus or the overreaction to it, mask wearing, all of those things. It's very much a symptom of a kind of a toxically intensified partisan polity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess sort of why I would be a bit pessimistic about saying that now that Biden's been elected, that everything is going to be fine. And I think it's actually
that?
I think people who are celebrating probably wish this, even if they know that it's probably not true. But I guess that's the sort of the point I'm trying to make here. I think this is actually bigger than just how people get information from the media. Like these are deep and systemic social cleavages, which the American political system seems to be incapable of being able to resolve for several institutional factors, and also just the structure of their party system means they can't aggregate interests in a way that is kind of coherent. The fact that the voting system pushes polarization rather than, forces in Australia which push towards the median voter. And the fact that I think this is the thing that I found really strange about some of the coverage around this is just like, why aren't they talking about voter suppression more? You know, like we had a record turnout somewhere between 68% and 72%. But how many people didn't vote because ultimately they couldn't or were denied?
Yep.
I think that's really important.
I would agree. Yeah. So I wrote a piece in the Sydney Morning Herald that came out the eve of Election Day talking about the three trends were demographic shifts, so millennials, disinformation, and disenfranchisement. This is only the second presidential election without the protections of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That was dismantled in 2013. And it meant that states could change polling places around. They could take people off the rolls. And we saw that in Georgia. One of the closest contested states of this election was also very close in 2018 for the governor's race. That's when the Secretary of State of Georgia was running for the office of governor. So in effect, he was in charge of his own election. This is a state which in only one of five states in which you vote on machine, there's no paper ballot or backup. And he won by 1.4% of the vote and then promptly took the lobbyist for the voting machine company to be his chief of staff. So when we look at some of the longstanding trends that were happening, some of the longstanding trends that are happening in Georgia, I think we can definitely see the effects of demographic shifts, right? Mm-hmm. There was a huge youth turnout in a lot of these states that flipped. Disinformation that we still see coming from the White House. But I think in Australia, it's hard for us to imagine the information ecosystem in which Americans live. If you're watching Fox News, you believe things like that the U.S. stands alone against the tyranny of the metric system. That was a real segment on primetime
Britain
Fox.
Is with them. You know, Brexit Britain has got their back
their
on this one.
Their economy is doing so great.
To say nothing of COVID disinformation. So there have been several studies that have tracked how people respond to the pandemic directly to who they were listening to, and specific shows like Hannity, like Rush Limbaugh, who called people who wear masks freaks, and said that people need to adapt like the Donner Party did. You know, that's the one that resulted in cannibalism. So if you're in this ecosystem, you are essentially in an alternative reality in which this vote result was preordained. Remember, Trump was telling everyone that there would be no God without him. And if you have captured that audience, that's right, if you've captured that audience, then they believe that this has been stolen from them and they are being incited to violence by the only person who personally benefits from remaining without remaining in legal immunity from prosecution.
Well, let's come back in a minute to that issue of the potential for violence, because there was sort of a lot of talk about it and a lot of cities were inner cities were boarded up and so forth. But just can we go back to the Voting Rights Act for a moment? You said it was dismantled in 2013. Just take us through take an Australian through what that is.
Sure. So this was an act passed in 1965. Looking straight at those southern states with Jim Crow laws. And it meant that when states who were in charge of their own elections, when they wanted to make changes, that had to be pre-cleared before the courts first. So I'll give you an example. In North Carolina, they did a study on how people vote. Now, that in itself is fine. But then they systematically went through and removed the things that African Americans used to vote. So early voting was cut in half. Same-day registration eliminated. Sunday voting gone. This is the difference between having the Voting Rights Act and not having it. Now, when they were called up to court about this, the court agreed that it happened with surgical precision to eliminate to disenfranchise some of these voters. And I remember one of the GOP spokesmen came on and said, it's not because they're African American. It's because they vote Democrat. So they see this they see this as legitimate. Now, without the restraints of the Voting Rights Act, what's happened is that states make these changes. So, for instance, in North Carolina, they went from, in one county, 12 polling places to one between one election and the next. So these long lines, some of these long queues are a function of design, right?
Not overwhelming voter turnout. They're an adjustment
for COVID, yeah. Exactly. And so those are the changes that happen on the ground. Remember, voting is happening on a weekday. And while employers do have to give you the time off, they don't have to pay you. And it's just a very different system without compulsory voting. And those changes made a difference in some of the key states that we saw in 2016.
North Carolina, for one, right? And that went to Obama in 2008. So,
but in 2012, we still had the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah, good point.
But I do take your point. North Carolina is something of a bellwether, and I don't say that just because I am from North Carolina. It was one of only two states to swing away from Obama. In 2012, the other was Indiana. So it's one of the states that's I carefully watch to see, if they're behaving. but also for these very tight margins, which tell us trends that might be in action. And they're one of the last states to call it, of course. So we're still waiting for North Carolina. They're accepting ballots until November 12th, as long as they're postmarked by Election Day, to allow overseas voters, military voters, get those ballots in.
Oh, I'm sure that the Donald's very relaxed about that. Maria, you made a really good point about, the various ways in which in Australia we have we've set the system up, the rules up of our political system, the structure of it, to draw, in effect, the middle, to really preference the middle, the majority of Australian voters. And you're talking about things like compulsory voting and preferential voting. One of the things that struck me, which was watching some of the mad ravings of various Republicans, and I think Rudy Giuliani is among the maddest that I saw over recent days. But, complaining about how in some of these states, these Democratic states, they'll make an application and it will go before a democratically appointed judge and therefore they won't get anywhere with it. And it struck me, as I guess it strikes Australians all the time, that isn't this what's wrong? Like, right, the politicization of the very judiciary is, it's a fundamentally different system from the one we have. We're talking so much at the moment about the potential, at least, for the Supreme Court to be making decisions about this election, right up to, at least in Trump's frame of reference, who won the election. A court that he only got through stacking about 8 or 10 days before the election.
After 60 million people had already voted.
Yeah. Right. it's just staggering that you raised this point the other day.
Yeah.
Is the US a democracy? And there's a whole range of ways in which that question, is a live question.
I thought it was remarkable that Rudy Giuliani was pouring scorn upon the networks for calling the election result and declared that the actual party that decides election outcomes was the courts. And I don't know. I always remember from my, textbooks, it was like the voters.
I believe they have a role in that somewhere.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Somewhere. But your point about the courts is really interesting. And a colleague of ours, Zoe Robinson, who does judicial politics, specializing in the United States and Australia, but she sort of was explaining to us that it's not only that Trump has stacked the Supreme Court, which is obviously very important, but that he's actually appointed 25% of federal court judges in his term. And part of that was because the Republican-dominated Senate obstructed the Obama administration's capacity to dominate, to appoint these judges, you know. And so this will have really long-term effects on court rulings like decades into the future, and obviously also provide a pool of future candidates for the Supreme Court. So and I think that it has been really interesting to hear multiple Republican pundits constantly invoking the courts as where elections are decided, which to me is disturbing.
Indeed. And remember, several of those appointees to judicial appointments were rated not qualified by the American Bar Association. And some of the questioning in the Senate was almost comical. Have you ever argued a case? No. Have you ever filed a motion? No. Have you ever watched Night Court? I mean, at what point does it become a farce? And we know exactly why the last two justices were appointed. They had never argued a case, and they were both part of the Florida recount on the Republican team in 2000. So it's clear that he had very clear intentions about what he intended them to do. And it's also a point about the Senate under Mitch McConnell, which may continue. We're still not sure. It's up in the air. Obstruction of more than 500 bills passed by the Democratic House, most of them on a bipartisan basis, and a prioritization of these judicial appointments above all else.
Well, it's interesting because when people think about an authoritarian or a non-democratic regime, I think a lot of the time we imagine that there's going to be, you know, black jack-booted stormtroopers goose-stepping down Pennsylvania Avenue under the banner of a swastika, right? But the fact is that a lot of authoritarians nowadays don't do things like that. They are much, much more subtle. So just been reading a book by Hannah Lucinda Smith called Erdogan Rising, which is about the rise to power of Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey. And he is very much a model for somebody like Donald Trump. So he doesn't have – so he has a sort of fanatical base of highly religious party supporters from the sort of rural heartland of Turkey that he opposes to the metropolitan elites of Istanbul and so on, so forth. And the way that he operates is not by assassinating his rivals. It's not by having jackbooted thugs going around smashing windows. It's by using the courts to a large degree. So it's about basically putting people in jail for various offences that they may have committed against him or criticizing him and so on. And it's also about getting control of the judiciary as well from people who might oppose him. So he purged the judiciary of supporters of this fellow Glenn, who was a former ally of his, and then put in his own loyalists who are then ruling on things like, for example, elections, right? So they have elections, but there's very obvious fraud. But because, of course, he's stacked the courts, he's been able to sort of get around it. So modern authoritarians are much, much smarter and much more subtle than the old kind of Hitler-Mussolini model of doing things. So when you hear people saying, oh, it's such ridiculous hyperbole to say that Trump and the Republicans are trying to make the United States a non-democratic country, you know, where are the jackboots? Well, no, that's not what it would actually look like. It would look like something much, much subtler than that.
It's very well said. And I might just say, it sounds like you're reading a piece that I wrote last week.
Yeah.
Because I agree. And I was sort of citing the Godwin's Law problem, you know, that as soon as you mentioned Hitler, you've lost the argument.
Yeah.
And the trouble with that is that it's precluded that kind of comparison that you're just making, that modern fascism or authoritarianism isn't going to look like it looked in the middle of the 20th century. It's going to look different. And
that's right. This one looks like attacking the post office, right?
Yeah,
that's the newest iteration is using innovative tools like sabotaging the post office. In court, the newest Trump appointee admitted that he had dismantled and destroyed 700 mail sorting machines in the months leading up to the election. Each one of those machines sorts 26,000 pieces of mail an hour. So if we're wondering about why ballots were slow to arrive, why they're slow to coming back, some of that is also by design.
Yeah, and this is a guy that's a former big donor to the Republican Party as well.
Absolutely, and holds conflict of interest in competing, sort of parcel industries.
Let's take a quick break and be back with this discussion in just a moment.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, before we had a break, we were just talking about the politicisation of the judiciary and a number of other aspects. Social media has been really interesting through this period, and particularly in the last couple of days. I mean, obviously, Donald Trump has kind of built a presidency around his social media profile. He's used it extraordinarily well. Chris Wallace was making the point on this podcast, I think makes the point in her book, How to Win an Election, that Trump described Twitter as, brilliant. It's like having your own newspaper, but with none of the on costs. and he certainly used it and other social media to drive his message, and used it with great effect. But of course, he's also extraordinarily embarrassing, some of the stuff that he's been saying, particularly since the result came out. And, you know, we were talking about Giuliani before. There's been some pretty wacky stuff going on the Republican side in particular, like the recent event that they had. Tell us about that. Okay.
Good work. Nice segue. I like it. Well, I mean, this is a beauty. I remember watching it on, I think it was Saturday. All the days in the last week have kind of blurred into one.
Yeah, they have.
Giuliani's giving this press conference disputing the election results in Pennsylvania. And he's standing in the back of, you know, just what looks like a kind of an industrial estate with a chemical hazard sign behind him, with all these Trump Pence signs everywhere. It looks like, you know, for those of you who are listening in Canberra, it's like Fishwick, basically, right? It's like one of those kind of places. And he sort of talks about it for a while. And then after a while, Twitter started to catch up on it, and they said, okay, well, where was this taking place? So Trump had originally said, important press conference at 11 o'clock in Four Seasons, Philadelphia. Now, Four Seasons, Philadelphia is a, unlike Trump's hotels, is a high-class urban downtown location where you would hold some kind of an important press conference.
It's a hotel, right?
But yeah, it's a hotel. Yeah, exactly. Half an hour later, he says, it's Four Seasons Landscaping, Philadelphia. And then, you know, that's where Giuliani shows up. And then people start Googling it, Four Seasons Philadelphia. And the first thing that shows up is Four Seasons Landscaping. And then you look at the Google Street View and they zoomed round. And in fact, what you've got on the other side, directly opposite, you can do this yourselves at home if you're like. On the other side, directly opposite, there is a crematorium. No symbolism there, of course. and then right next to it, there is an adult bookstore. Again, no symbolism there. So what most likely seems to have happened, and the Trump campaign are trying to deny this and say there's some other reason and that there was, you know, but what most likely happened was they had some kind of a staffer who was told, book the Four Seasons in Philadelphia, Google Four Seasons. The first thing that comes up is Four Seasons Landscaping, doesn't notice it, gives them a call, and then Four Seasons Landscaping are like, sure,
kudos to the guy who answered, or gal who was working reception that day and just rolled with it.
That person wins the election, right? I mean, that's really,
and they've just done a press release to say, listen, if any presidential candidate had called, we would be more than happy to host that event.
Exactly.
But don't worry, we'll have merchandise up by Monday. I'm really hoping that they have a lawn and order.
Lawn and order, that's good.
T-shirt, I'll be buying it.
You know,
follow them on Facebook.
Because there was a fair bit of jocularity about this. People were taking great delight in it. I saw one because it was between, as you say, a crematorium and a shop that sold dildos. person said that Trump was caught between a cock and a chard place.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
It's brilliant.
But it is a metaphor, right, of the mismanagement, the incompetence, but still going ahead.
Right, I know, yeah.
Just push on.
It'd be easier, rather than just, you know, like saying, sorry, we're changing it to a different location. I mean, I'm sure, so their excuse was that they wanted, like, there would be too many pro-Biden protesters if they held it at the downtown Four Seasons in Philadelphia. So they moved it to there. But then why did they have to move it to another place called the Four Seasons? Couldn't they just find another hotel, maybe the airport or, you know, a golf club out of town? It just doesn't – that it is blatantly the funny thing is what happened.
They could have so easily salvaged it. Any political strategist would have retorted with, well, of course the elites would expect us to show up in a high-class hotel, but we're here with a small to medium enterprise supporting local business.
That's what Corey Lewandowski did actually say. He said many good patriotic Americans use – Four Seasons Landscaping Philadelphia for all their gardening needs. We are proud to support. It's something along those lines. You know? Yeah.
Too late. Right.
Duck into the adult bookstore.
No, many patriotic Americans use, you know.
Well, their campaign's gone to mulch. That's the best you can say about it. But we're in this now, this legal twilight zone, right? We've got all these threats of legal action and applications, claims of voter fraud and malfeasance and incompetence and everything else. Where's all this going to end? I mean, from what we understand, a good many of these things are going to be regarded as frivolous.
So far, they're 0 and 10.
Right.
So if
they've done out of it is an order from a court to make sure there are scrutineers from both sides watching the count, right?
Which already happens, and most of these countings are happening on live stream. Yeah. So this charge that there aren't electioneers is just frivolous. Now, I'll say that, if you're charging fraud in front of a court, they require this thing we used to call evidence.
Yeah, it used to be really big.
Exactly, about what kind of fraud, who, where perpetrated, through what means. And if those conditions of evidentiary support aren't met, then they can invoke Rule 11, which is sanctions for whoever's bringing this frivolous lawsuit. And of course, you can see that Trump is already concerned about some of these court cases because he has been launching emails every hour on the hour to his supporters. And half of whatever contributions that he might bring in have been designated in the fine print on those same emails as going to his campaign fund. So he is, facing penury in multiple avenues.
Yeah. Well, tell us about that, because he's made a comment at one point that he can actually pardon himself during this lame duck period, hasn't he?
Yes, that was a very interesting discussion that he had, I believe, in 2018 about pardoning one's self. And in fact, I wouldn't be so hasty for merchandisers to start printing out Biden 46 because he might be 47. Trump would appoint, is to step down and Pence would take over as number 46, perhaps to pardon him. But keeping in mind,
so let's Trump, just be clear about that, because it took me a moment to understand what you were saying. But
must be the accent.
No, it's my lack of intelligence, actually. So what you're saying is that they could actually do a switcheroo in this lame duck period, and at that point, Pence could say, you're absolved of any.
That's right, just like Ford pardoned Nixon when Nixon resigned.
Yeah.
And so
– another great moment.
Exactly. And the dangers of not prosecuting office holders who think they are above the law.
Okay. And that doesn't get him free of state prosecutions for various things, does it?
Exactly, which is why Michael Steele, who was the former chair of the Republican National Committee, tweeted out straight away in responses to Trump's false claims to have won. He tagged in the New York Attorney General and said, SDNY, he's all yours.
Yeah, Pence is the Admiral Donuts for Donald Trump.
Though I wonder why Pence would agree to do that.
Well, to be president just for a couple of days. Like donuts, it's the same kind of thing. He was only in charge for a couple of days and he had one job and that was it. But at least he got to do it.
Well, Black Jack McEwen was prime minister of this country for 23 days and they're putting a statue up around the lake and they're spending $900,000 on it. I know I've changed eras and governments. But I'm just
making
a better point.
Comparison than that.
You're right.
Exactly, exactly. What would you do to get into the history books, I ask? Yeah. Not this!
Not that. Pardon Donald Trump. That's all I did. His little presidential biography. He pardoned Donald Trump. That's it.
Yeah. Perhaps not join the GOP, which Trump himself only did, not that long ago. Right. I mean, it was an interesting point that I heard someone making over you know, as you say, the long day that the long single day that has occurred since the
since absolutely. The they used to use that as a major deflection of any criticism. Well, he was a Democrat then,
yeah,
or he was a private citizen then, which immediately morphed into, well, he's a president now,
yeah.
So completely right. immune from criticism on all fronts.
But isn't it staggering when you think about that? Because this Republican was making the point that he had no strong links in the Republican Party, and certainly not in Washington, when he secured the nomination. You know, by the time he had, in a relatively short time, he has entirely captured this party. A bit like, you know, you were saying with Erdogan. I mean, it's been a very comprehensive takeover of a party that used to be part of the system and is now sort of likes to see itself as outside the orthodoxy.
But he did have the base of the Tea Party movement, you know. So it's not like the it's not like as if the Republican Party was in fine health before. Trump came along, and it will be actually very interesting to sort of see what the sort of, I guess, institutional legacy of Trumpism within the Republican party is. It's been interesting to sort of see, I guess, the establishment distance themselves from him and emphasize, I suppose, the sort of, you know, counting the legal votes kind of dimension of the whole show, which, you know, I guess as an Australian, again, like the whole idea of like having time limits on when the ballots can come in is just odd.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah, there's the congressional scholar Norm Ornstein has very strong words to say about the Republican Party, having studied them for 40 years, and he calls it asymmetric polarization.
Yeah.
That is, the Republican Party has drifted much farther to the right than the Democratic Party has drifted to the left. Mm. To the effect that they see, you know, on the Republican side, they are openly hostile to bipartisanship, openly hostile to, you know, to the citizens and their voting and their franchise. And I think that Pew Research has some terrifying results on polarization in the United States, that about 40% of both parties see each other as the main threat to the United States.
Oh yeah, I was just going to say. I mean, I think there's a couple of points coming out of this for the Democrats. And I mean, I know that a lot of, so we've spoken an awful lot about Donald Trump. We haven't said so much about Joe Biden. And I know a lot of people were very, very skeptical about Joe Biden when he started running for the Democratic nomination. There's even still people skeptical about him now. You know, lots and lots of the sort of Bernie bro types on Twitter saying, well, you know, it's a really anemic campaign, and if it had been Bernie, he would have won on a landslide, et cetera, et cetera. But I think what this misses out is something that you were alluding to, Jennifer, which was the fact that the Democrats are a much more heterogeneous coalition than the Republicans are, which means that they inevitably have to have somebody who's a little bit of everything. Somebody who has a little bit for the Democratic Socialists, a little bit for the sort of socially liberal tech types, a little bit for the socially liberal Wall Street types, a little bit for the sort of woke people, and a little bit for, you know, like religious church-going African Americans who are kind of the backbone of the Democratic Party.
And a little bit for working Americans.
For working
Americans. The traditional base of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, unionized white working class Americans. So the thing is that the leader of the Democratic Party has to be, rather than the sort of a champion of a tribe, he has to be kind of like the leader of a coalition of people. He or she has to be the leader of a coalition of people. So if you have someone who's just kind of like a blue state champion, basically, blue states loosely defined to mean people who are very strong partisan Democrats, then that's not really going to work, I don't think, for them in the same way as the same thing would work for the Republicans. Because although it might enthuse a lot of people in the Democrats' base, it's going to lose an awful lot of people who in the other end of the Democratic Party. People who might not, you know, people who might even move over to the Republicans. All of a sudden,
Is it possible to, you know, we can't throw ourselves forward even 3 weeks and know what Trump's going to do. But let's just, for the sake of it, throw forward, you know, a decade. Is it possible that this trend continues and, you know, that we end up with a party that is – we end up with a bifurcation in the political system where the Republicans are representing the regions and rural Americans and the Democrats are representing the urban areas? I mean – it's hard to see how that would work because of the electoral system itself, the way it's divided, the way the electoral college works and everything else. But there are elements of that in this result now. We can even see it with states that would be red states except for the capital cities, you know, Philadelphia or whatever it might be, that are, you know, that deliver it for the Democrats.
Well,
is that tendency on the move, I suppose, is what I'm talking
hard
about.
Hard to say this. I mean, you know, like 10 years in advance, it's very, very difficult to make.
Okay, really make it nine. Just
make it nine. Okay, we'll make it easier. How about we just keep sort of decreasing it in year sort of segments? But I think that the Democrats, I mean, they do have a problem, a very difficult, tricky kind of balancing act to make, because if they did decide to become a relatively ideologically homogenous social democratic party, if you like, the American Labour Party, so to speak, as, you know, Bernie Sanders or AOC or whoever would want them to be, then perhaps they might be able to reach out a little bit more to the kind of Trump voting white working class people in Ohio or Pennsylvania. And they also might be able to sort of get a real kind of hard core cadre of people who would always show up and always campaign for them and always be pushing them to the left in the same way that you have these people on the right. But at the same time, there's a lot of people in the United States who I think are very, very influential, certainly very financially influential in terms of their campaign contributions and so on, who are economically very pro market while being socially very liberal. And these people have a very, very strong influence on the Democratic Party. So if you look at, again, like the tech people, the sort of Wall Street people as well, you know, people who are like absolutely firmly in favor of gay marriage, firmly in favor of women's rights, firmly in favor of immigration and so on. And they might say, well, we wouldn't mind paying a little bit more taxes in order for everyone to have healthcare. But if push came to shove and they're standing there in the ballot box, would they actually genuinely vote for that if that's what they were given? So the problem is, if the Democrats do move in this Bernie Sanders kind of way, then they've got this very important part of their base, certainly in terms of influence over public debate and in terms of campaign contributions and so on, who may just about be tempted by a slightly more sane and competent version of Donald Trump to come over to the Republicans.
And this is not hard to imagine, is it? I mean, we see this in Australia. We see the Labor Party dealing with this you know, game of Twister, as it were, sort of trying to cover these very the positions it needs to take. We saw what happened to Labor with its vote in Queensland, Maria, at the last election, and we know the lengths that Labor's going to sort of be, you know, sort of assertive on climate change, but somehow speak to its its base in the, you know, up and down the East Coast in the energy sector.
Yeah, absolutely.
Coal mining in particular.
I mean, I think to sort of continue on sort of some of the things that Charlie was saying, right? You know, there's obviously, when you're dealing with a really polarized polity and you've got your extreme party activists, like the issues that are motivating them are not the issues that are motivating the median voter. The issues that motivate the median voter is economics. Like we know this from decades of data. Mm. You know, it can shift around sometimes. Immigration can be another kind of cross-cutting cleavage, and we see a lot of evidence of this in Australia, which is sort of delinked traditional left-wing voters and put them onto the back of right-wing parties. But, you know, like if you think about it in another way, lots of people who are unhappy with a candidate like Biden because he's boring are progressive. And what does that word mean? It means being ahead of the curve. And so, you know, and they're basically opposed to people who are reactionaries, who radically want to return to a bygone era. But most people are actually quite conservative. Like, that's the reality of it. And I think that's one of the sort of problems. And you can see it a little bit here too in Australia because of the way our voting system works in the lower house, right? Whereas if you've got like progressive voters who are deeply dissatisfied with the sort of, you know, light red politics of the Labor Party, for example, or the light blue politics of the Democratic Party, who then get angry at people for not being ahead of the curve with them, right? Mm. And that's just weird. Well, when you break it down,
it is in a way, but it's also just it's a surprise. Except when you think about it, you think, well, by definition, people who go to church are more religious. People who go to a political party and actually join it are more politically committed.
Well,
more
sad, mad, and lonely, right? Isn't that what people say? Like party members say about themselves.
Well,
right?
I think we're getting into another area of sociology.
Well, I think there's a tendency to have a post-mortem for the Democratic Party, regardless of whether they win or whether they lose.
Yeah.
And the facts are that that Biden has won 75 million votes, the most votes of anyone in history. This was a continuation of the 2018 midterms. And a quick glance at the picture of the incoming congressional class of the Republicans and the Democrats show you which one is more representative of America and which one is not. And at this point, the Republican Party's idea of diversity is having two QAnon conspiracy theorists elected to Congress.
Oh, God.
While on the other side, what I see is more of a longstanding fracture is going to be the anti-science division, where they are openly mainstreaming conspiracy theories and conspiracy theorists into high office in the Republican Party versus the incredible and increasing appeal on the Democratic side of scientists, physicians, nurses. That's what we saw in 2018, these non-traditional occupations running for office. And even former intelligence agents. Now, these are people who really value their anonymity. But the fact that they've identified Trump and the Republican Party as a potential threat that they look at when they're studying other polities and they felt they needed to step up, I think is more indicative of where these two parties are going.
Even the military actually were, you know, from the poll, Military Times poll suggests the first time, I don't know when this has ever happened before in American politics, the military were breaking a majority of them for Biden.
Yeah, I saw this too, and I noticed that some people were pointing out that perhaps they didn't like being called losers by the commander-in-chief.
Well, the fact is that he has attacked every single branch separately.
Yeah.
So
even the Marine Corps?
Even the Marines. Oh, so, really? Well, they're part of the Navy. And remember, he dismissed the naval captain who sounded the alarm about COVID on his ship. Yeah. When Lieutenant Colonel Vindman testified in impeachment hearings, the Army had to provide security for one of its own against Trump and his supporters and death threats. And so, you know, he's attacked individual personnel. He's interfered in military courts of justice. And people see that meddling and are very concerned. It's why 781 national security officials signed a letter supporting Biden. But I think what happens in some of these discussions is we're really just talking about the phenomenon that's pretty axiomatic for marketers, which is that Republicans fall in line behind their nominee. Democrats have to fall in love.
Yeah. I think that's about right. Now, just before we get to the end, let's look at the sort of implications of a Biden presidency in terms of, say, the national foreign policy and national security or international security implications. There's a lot of talk about Biden reframing the relationship with China, or, you know, at least reconfiguring it to some extent, taking some of the heat out of it. There's obviously the climate change issue, taking America back into the Paris Accord. What's your reading of is expectation management important here, or will there be quite dramatic shifts?
I mean, I think that what Biden is going to offer the rest of the world, which I think is the reason why pretty much every world leader is breathing an enormous sigh of relief, with the exception of the Orbans and Bolsonaros and Kim Jong-uns, is the fact that he is going to offer a fairly predictable, stable US foreign policy. Now, I mean, people are talking, and I've had this question quite a lot about relations with China, and people talk like Trump is, you know, very heavily anti-China, you know, the more hawkish candidate on China. But, I mean, if you go back just a little bit
through
his relations with Xi Jinping, the point is not so much that his, and I know people on the radio can't see this, it's not so much that his relations with China are right down there towards the negative end or right up there towards the positive. It's the fact that they fluctuate wildly between the two. And that's what's dangerous about him in the international realm, is the fact that he's simply so erratic and unpredictable and so based on his own personal feelings towards the leader of that country.
Exactly. It's mercurial and not strategic, particularly. Yeah, it's political and it's emotional.
And it's scary because, you know, like one of the things that they say in international relations, one of the things that I teach my students, and if any of them are listening, you know, you'll see the application of this, is that unpredictability is a major cause of war. So say, for example, you have the United States and one of its allies is getting challenged by one of its adversaries. Say, I don't know, China and Japan, right? Now, if China knows that the United States will jump in on Japan's side, China is not going to challenge Japan. If Japan knows for sure that the United States is not going to jump in on their side, Japan's not probably going to concede to China and let them have what they want. The danger is when maybe they come to opposite judgments about what the United States is going to do. Say China thinks, well, the United States will probably stay out because Trump said X, Y, and Z nice things about Xi Jinping. And Japan thinks, well, the United States will probably help us because they say, Trump said X, Y, Z bad things about China. So then they're coming to contrasting judgments about what the United States will do. And given that this is a major, this will be a major factor in what's going to happen in the war, then they come to contrasting judgments about what's going to happen in the war. And that's when you get the war occurring. Okay. Mm. If you look at Jeff Blaney, one of the great Australian historians, saying uncertainty is a major cause of war because in order for a war to happen, at least one of the sides has got to misjudge what's going to happen. Mm. And when the attitude of the United States, the number one global superpower, is unclear, that's when those kind of things are going to start to kick off. So that was always my major concern. That for me was the biggest tail risk of Donald Trump in the international arena, is that because he is so erratic and unpredictable, it is really, really difficult for either America's allies or adversaries to really know what's going to happen. And that's the scariest. That was the in the domestic realm, the scariest thing was this move towards quasi-authoritarianism a la Erdogan or Orban. In the international realm, it is this mercurial unpredictability about him that was the real problem.
And do you think that's going to now, like, Biden's going to steer back towards a more orthodox and more predictable position? Will that manifest in a clearly more sort of multilateralist approach as well? Will he rebuild relations with the European continent, for example?
Yes, I think so.
Get back into Paris.
Rejoin the WHO.
Became enemy number one or enemy number two behind
there was even
China.
Talk that Trump might have pulled the United States out of NATO if he'd won a second term. Now, I mean, that would have been
well. Huge. And Fox News was on the job, let me tell you. So really? If I'm looking at Hannity's show,
a lot of it. Poo
he's
you.
Put. Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, if I want to have a conversation with my dad, I have to watch Rush Limbaugh and Fox to know where the talking points are coming from, so I can debunk in advance. On Sean Hannity's show, a couple of years ago, when Trump refused to commit to Article 5 of mutual defense, Hannity put up this figure of U.S. contributions to NATO. Mm. Now, that number was astronomical. Mm. It was $720 billion a year. Now, anyone in the defense space listening knows that that is not the contribution to NATO, which is closer to $500 million. That is the entirety of the U.S. defense budget. But by presenting that large number, it feeds into that siege mentality. Look, we're being taken advantage of. Look at all this money we send overseas and we offshore when we have here needs at home need to be met. Mm. But I think the capriciousness is important to note. Mm. The only stability in Trump's decision-making was whether it would impact his portfolio.
Yeah, that's right.
And we saw that with the Muslim ban. His first executive order, his first week in office, after he had declared, his first order was to declare his inauguration the day of patriotic devotion. The second thing was to file for re-election. The third was actually this Muslim ban. And notice that excluded all countries in which he did business.
Yeah.
Exactly. Whereas Biden has specifically and upheld this promise the entirety of his political career not to own a single stock.
And I think this sort of what you guys are saying kind of underlines the point about Trump. You know, not only was he erratic and mercurial and, often driven by his own kind of personal vanity, but, you know, he has attacked American institutions across the board at every single level. Like, that is one of the reasons why the coronavirus pandemic has gone out of control, because he literally stripped people with expertise out of those decision-making mechanisms. And Biden is inheriting a bit of a smoldering dumpster fire, right? a pandemic where, the America just broke a record number of infections again today, beating yesterday, which was a record-breaking day, beating the day before, which was a record-beating day. There's 10 million infections in that country. There is only so many things that can be repaired in 4 years' time, particularly when you are facing an obstructionist Senate and a political system in general that has too many veto players. And I think this is the sort of alarming kind of thing. Like, how much damage have American institutions sort of sustained? Like, well, we will get to know that in the next 4 to 8 years.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about that, it's an allied question to it. How much damage have those institutions sustained, and to what extent? Let's even assume that Trump himself moves off the stage somehow. To what extent will political players sort of take instruction from the successful aspect of his approach, that is simply declaring black is white or whatever. I mean, that example you gave of the US contribution to NATO, for example, or we've seen it since the election, the claims about, big parcels of votes suddenly arriving at 4 a.m. in the morning. What we see here is a similar mechanism, which is you get a big lie out there to your supporters, and then it becomes this truth that they carry around in their hearts, that they go to the streets, they rally. This is proof that they are being dudded. It's sort of victim politics, conspiracy and all that sort of stuff, grievance politics.
This is the worry, is that he could end up being a sort of a John the Baptist figure for an even worse authoritarian, because he may be the John the Baptist figure for an authoritarian Republican Party candidate who is just that little bit less vulgar, just that little bit less erratic, just that little bit less corrupt, a little bit less incompetent, but also has the same kind of authoritarian tendencies, personalistic leadership style. Again, if you look at these other populist leaders, your Erdogan, Orban, Bolsonaro to some extent.
Well, see, Erdogan comes along initially as a moderate and with strong secular credentials.
Yeah, and Putin
the
as
longer,
well.
Yeah, and the longer he stays there, and Orban is a great example as well. Yeah. You know, I mean, Madeleine Albright, used to talk about Orban in very, very favorable terms. She knew him when he studied in America, and he becomes, this strong man.
Yeah, or Netanyahu. Netanyahu's very,
They love.
Yeah. Well, this is it. So, the vulnerability, Trump has identified these vulnerabilities and he was too incompetent to take advantage of them. But somebody who is more competent, however, who has a very similar worldview, that person could be genuinely very dangerous for the United States.
Yeah, I agree. Someone who can actually learn on the job, because that seems to me to be the most spectacular single failure of Trump is his sort of stubborn unwillingness. He's lazy as hell, for a start. Yeah. I mean, the fact that when the result was finally declared, he was playing golf, it sort of said everything.
On the back nine. And I remember last year, this was demonstrated in, emergency services very clearly, where he had received or read information about a hurricane path, which he stuck to, regardless of whether that hurricane ended up going. And so in the White House, he decides to print off this meteorological map and use a Sharpie to change the route of this hurricane to match his outdated information. Then they sold that Sharpie on his website for $15, autographed, with setting the record straight.
So they're profiting off this. He never wanted to be a politician. He just wants to sell stuff. And the person Charlie's talking about actually wants to do the job.
Right.
And that's the scary thing.
Well, I used to think that about Marco Rubio. I actually originally thought, when Donald Trump was going beating Marco Rubio for the Republican, I was actually quite glad, because I thought, first of all, he's never going to win. And secondly, at least he's not as belligerent in international affairs as Marco Rubio is. Now, maybe it's not him. Maybe he has more respect for the democratic process. But somebody like that, somebody's a little bit more polished, a little bit more competent, but has the same authoritarian tendencies. So this guy, actually, he's a North Carolina boy. Madison Crawthorne, did you see him?
I did. I mentioned him on the project the other day.
Oh, yeah. Can you tell us about him?
Yes. This candidate is a millennial. He's very young. He's 29. He has an LLC, but not much other job experience. He lied about getting into the military and then getting into
a
car accident.
That's a prerequisite for high office.
Exactly. lied about getting into the military before being paralyzed in a car accident. And then it came to some very unfortunate old Instagram photos of him, waxing pure poetic about the Führer in
Berchtesgaden.
Yeah, exactly. In Eagle's Nest, Hitler's vacation house. He won his seat in North Carolina. Looking at you, North Carolina. And the first thing he tweeted was, cry more, lib. Yeah. So this is the group that they're really appealing to, these grievance. They're sore winners. They're sore losers.
It's actually even worse with him, actually. So what his LLC is called? It's called SPQR. Now,
from Rome.
SPQR, Senatus Populesque Romanus, which was supposedly...
Well, I knew that, obviously.
I just thought I'd drop some Latin to be a smart arse, right? But it was the supposedly on the standards carried by the Roman legions, which, seems like an obscure reference. But on the alt-right, it's a kind of a coded thing for the alt-right groups who use SPQR as their kind of calling card, if you like. That's one of the symbols that they use. And if you weren't in the alt-right or clued up about them, you wouldn't get the reference. That's the thing. It's a very, very subtle dog whistle. SPQR LLC. And there was something else about him. So he's going to Berchtesgaden and posting these things about it's so great to be in Hitler's, you know, former kind of place and all that. And there was also something like the number 18 has a particular kind of significance in these kind of alt-right circles because the first letter of the alphabet is A.
Sorry, 88.
What's that?
It's 88.
88, is it?
Not 18.
Not 18.
Don't ask me why I know this.
It's 88, yeah.
Because Heil Hitler.
But there's also 18 as well.
Oh, I thought it was 14 with the 14 words.
A-H. So there's like...
Oh, they're very numerical, these fascists.
Right, they are. But it's a code that they use. And there's certain things about his website that people say, and that could be a coincidence, but he always has 18. It's something like he always has 18 posts or 18. Like, there seems to be the use of the number 18 a lot, which, I mean, again, sounds like really kind of crazy paranoid stuff. But it's just, you know, it's the kind of thing you can plausibly deny. And then there's another one. What was it he did? Oh, yeah. Like, so on his campaign website, he said, this, you know, my opponent has a track record of going away to work for non-white men like Cory Booker, right? So that's not even a dog whistle. That's straight up racism. So, I mean, somebody like him, and he looks like, I mean, like, honestly, he looks like a young up-and-coming SS Panzer commander, right? So you think about... guy, you know, maybe somebody like him in a few years' time, right, who's a lot more subtle and a lot cleverer about the way that he says it. Maybe, again, it's not him, but somebody like him who then notes the vulnerabilities that Trump has been able to exploit. That's scary.
Yeah, my money's on Ivanka. Because then they can play the feminist card. Well, obviously, if you don't support her,
she seems to be the least insane of them. Maybe I'm just clutching at straws.
Don't fall for it.
Thanks so much for this discussion. It's been a lot of fun, and I guess I'm a lot happier to be saying it in the lee of the end of the Trump period than its continuation. Yeah. Because as I think we've all agreed, you think the first term was mad. Imagine what a second term when you didn't have to seek re-election would have been like. So Drs. Maria Traflaga, Jennifer Hunt and Charlie Miller, thanks for being on Democracy Sausage, and we'll be back again later in the week.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.